50 and a 300-foot drop to the valley floor. I remember Manal just Spalding Gray's admonition based on his time in Indonesia. Never drive in a country that believes in reincarnation. With the cool heights of Thimphu behind us, we follow the National Highway as it climbs through pine and hemlock forest. It crosses over the Dochula Pass at 10,300 feet and then quickly descends into the lush and fertile Punaka Valley. What I see overwhelms me. It's so beautiful as to be impossible. Every turn of the head presents a new tableau, as basic as a splash of watercolor on a piece of parchment, as complex as the patterns in a peacock's tail feathers. One such vista includes not peacocks, but cranes, flying low in loose formation over the surface of a tumbling river, across which a farmer drives his team of riding ponies. This landscape exists to be painted by a master. But wait, it gets better. In a low grassy field, approximately 100 yards apart, two groups of traditionally clad archers let loose a volley of arrows in a high parabola. After reaching their apex, the darts rocket down to their targets. Adding drama to their competition, one or two members of the receiving team always seem to be directly in the path of the incoming projectiles. They step spirally out of the way before instructing their archers to return fire. Laughter and Punakan smack talk rings through the lush valley. It's a scene both exotic and as familiar to me as an old Wide World of Sports episode. Most of the river valley is dedicated to rice paddies. Now and then in the distance, a house and outbuildings overlook the terraces. Odd but attractive conflations of pagoda and alpine chalet. The structures are rustic but well-built. It must be reported that almost every home is conspicuously adorned with a larger-than-life-size painting of a phallus, sometimes more than one. A cluster of three, arranged like flowers, creates a sort of bouquet of boners. The consensus seems to be that they bring good luck, but no one can tell us with certainty when all this penis portraiture became part of life in Bhutan. But the oldest structure that sports a phallus is a 15th-century monastery. Today, these paintings adorn residences and businesses and even some schools and restaurants. Invited inside of one of these homes, Nell, the crew, and I fit comfortably into the surprisingly large wood-paneled central room, furnished with a number of pillows on the floor surrounding a wood stove. The farmer, his wife, and their children offer us a traditional lunch of chilies and cheese with red rice, served at a low table that we all gather around. The language barrier is deep and wide, but with our guides translating, we manage to share thoughts, ideas, and even humor. Like most farmers in Bhutan, they express great satisfaction in their labor and pride in the result. Aside from the beautiful sun-warm faces of our host family, my fondest memory of the meal is the sweet taste of warm goat's milk offered to me by the family matriarch. After bidding goodbye to our hosts and presenting them with gifts of betel nut leaves and beer, I take a short walk down to the rice paddies. Keeping my eyes peeled for cobras, I dance along the ridge rows. I've been in Bhutan for 3 days. My fellow travelers may have picked up on this new kick in my step, but I'm not talking about it. I feel like if I acknowledge it, I'll chase it away. Move along, Mike. Nothing to see here. I already sense its impermanence. I'm not cured, but I feel no less grateful. No jump from the wheelchair, toss the crutches aside. It's a miracle moment. It isn't like that. Just a few moments of grace that seem to be spilling over into days. The following morning, we hurry to our next location, where I will sit still for hours, an impossible feat under normal circumstances. Cross-legged beyond impossible, amid monks and thousands of Bhutanese. We are attending the Punaka Festival, a religious and cultural gathering at the intersection of the rivers Pho Chu and Mo Chu. Our guide, Se Wang, accompanies me to the center of the vortex. The riot of color and costume, incense and intensity, unfolds in the courtyard of the colossal Punaka Zong, a massive stone fortress that previously served as Bhutan's administrative capital. The crowd makes way for warriors who dance among us, reenacting the 400-year-old Bhutanese victory over Tibet. Drummers pound and dancers weave and sway as the clamor and clang of the celebration dissolves in the ear like a hum. A young monk, swathed in a crimson robe, offers me a fallen leaf from the courtyard's Bodhi tree. He clasps his hand, closes his eyes, and nods gently. What would it be like to live a life like this? A nest too far. We spend our last full day of filming back in Paro. Our plan is to visit Tiger's Nest, a 17th-century Buddhist monastery clinging to a cliffside in the upper Paro Valley. Most of our group won't make it all the way to the sacred temple, but we'll still have a rigorous hike to the Taksang Cafeteria, a tea house at the halfway point. During our pre-production meetings in New York, it was assumed that given my health issues and the ruggedness of the trail and the six-hour round-trip journey, I would sit out this portion of the shoot and later provide narration to the footage our crew would collect. There was surprise and some concern when I announced the night before the hike that I'm going to take part. I informed Rudy and Nell that I will go with them as far as the tea house, but this is still no walk in the park. Our vehicles commandeered the parking lot at the base of the trail and disgorged producers, crew, Bhutanese guides, Nina, and me. We hit the trail, a winding cart path and a hell of a steep trek. We come across a young Bhutanese girl, around 8 or 9 years old, selling trinkets and betel nut leaves. My guide, Se Wong, communicates to her that we can't stop the shop now. She smiles, lets us pass, and then by her own secret route, scampers ahead and is waiting trailside when we round the next switchback to make another sales pitch. Amazed that it is the same girl and wholly impressed by her initiative, I purchase a little wooden box from her to put my Bodhi leaf in. She shows up 3 switchbacks later just to say thank you. We reach the tea house, gulping for air and gawking at the vista. Taking advantage of the stunning background, we shoot some B-roll footage and set it for a couple of quick interviews. Rudy points the camera at me and tosses out a few simple questions. So what do you think? Are these the happiest people on Earth? I answer, they don't claim to be. Sure, the people of Bhutan are friendly, engaging, and yes, happy and welcoming. But the contention was never that they were the happiest people on Earth, but that they had found a formula for measuring and nurturing happiness. What makes gross national happiness more than just a silly government policy is the earnestness of the population to cooperate and participate in the things that make life richer, and not just from an economic perspective. And you, Rudy queries, how are you doing? With a smile, I describe the relief from Parkinson's symptoms I've been experiencing since arriving in the country. I can't explain it, and I don't need to, as my physical presence, steady and spasm-free, says it all. As for my state of mind, I give an account of feeling grateful. Unable to fully understand the renewal and wellness I'm currently enjoying, I simply welcome it and surf the wave. I look over my shoulder at Tiger's Nest. At that moment, I decide that I'm going to climb as high as I can today. We chug the last of our tea and pack extra water. I transfer the Bodhi leaf from my wallet into the small wooden box and hand it to Nina for safekeeping. Normally, I would take it for luck, but I already feel plenty lucky. After some demanding and inhospitable terrain, we're able to get a closer view of Tiger's Nest. There's still a great distance to go, but it's a more captivating perspective than from the tea house. Melded into the jagged cliff face, as if by sheer force of will, is the temple. Its white pagoda-like segments perched upon a series of red rooftops bring to mind a layered wedding cake. Thousands of prayer flags dance in the breeze. The belief is this is the place where Guru Padmasambhava arrived on a flying tigress in the 8th century, meditating in the caves for 3 years before emerging to bring Buddhism to Bhutan. I would welcome a ride if the tigress shows up because I don't know how much further I can go. Satisfied with my effort, I inform Se Wong that this is far enough for me. With that, I spit on my palm, grip my walking stick, and go back down to the tea house in half the time it took to climb up. Now, on the switchback part of the trail, I find myself struggling to maintain a measured pace. The loose scree, marbles of gravel beneath my boots, causes me to travel faster than I intended. Ironically, this is similar to a Parkinsonian problem called festination, literally to act or move at a high speed. This is when our footfall increases at a faster rate than our bodies can maintain. Our stride shortens and we find ourselves feet together, up on our toes, starting to pitch forward. It occurs to me that I'm about to do an ugly face plant, with momentum. Quick decision, tamp the velocity of falling forward and down by throwing myself sideways. In doing this, I take a shortcut 30 feet through the brush to the next switchback. The incident cost me a pound of flesh and a case of Himalayan road rash. At least I don't take out any young Bhutanese entrepreneurs. The stuntman in me is chagrined that half our camera crew is still climbing to Tiger's Nest, while the others are waiting down at the trailhead. No one was there to capture on video my heroic forward shoulder roll. Along with my intrepid guide, Nell and Nina are the first on the scene. They find my wipeout horrifying until they see that I'm okay, and then they find it hilarious. As for Se Wong, he miraculously produces a first aid kit from inside his go, and is already swabbing the cuts and scrapes with alcohol. He wipes the bloody scratches and picks up the pebbles embedded in the palms of my hands. Se Wong looks worried, either about me or his job security. I like to think it is the former. I notice that one of the fingers on my left hand seems a little wonky, but it doesn't hurt. Color my world. That evening, our last night in Bhutan, we have dinner with the guides and the crew at our hotel in Paro. It also happens to be Nell's birthday. There are gifts for her and for our guides and officials. I appreciate the warm spirits, but I'm getting worried about my finger, particularly its swelling and discoloration. After an unrestful sleep, I awake with the vestiges of a dream flickering in my brain. In it, an elephant was stepping on my hand, and it hurt like hell. Once I'm conscious, I find no elephant in the room. However, the pain is achingly present. My wedding band is a problem. I'll be careful who I say that to. It's constricting the blood flow to the jammed up digit, and there is no way to remove it. I assure myself the swelling will eventually subside and the ring will slide off. I get up and pack. By mid-morning, we have all the gear loaded and are on our way to the next production location in India. During the first leg of the flight, the cabin pressure does me no favors. My finger is screaming. I'm quietly doing Lamaze breathing. I look out the plane's window, pressing my forehead against the glass, and fantasize about parachuting onto a random Himalayan peak and plunging my hand into the snow. The fingers of my other hand carry their own message. It's time to take my Parkinson's meds. I haven't had this strong or sudden a cue since my arrival in Bhutan. How can I miss you if you won't stay away, I mutter. We stop in Kathmandu, take on more passengers, and quickly depart for Delhi. A well-dressed Nepali gentleman sits down in the aisle seat next to me. He gives me a polite nod. Then with a furrow on his brow, he glances down at my hand. He meets my eyes and says, "Forgive me, I can't help but notice your finger." "Yeah," I say, "I banged it up in a fall." "How long ago was that?" he asks. "Yesterday afternoon, tiger's nest." "I'm a doctor," he informs me. "May I examine your hand?" I didn't have any better offers. "Sure," I say. He takes my hand and gently pokes around the ring finger. I wince. "If you don't remove that ring soon, your finger will be coming off with it." I let out a nervous chuckle. He's kidding, right? But his reaction is sober. "When you get to Delhi, you must go directly to the hospital. I'll have the pilot call ahead." We land in Delhi. The doctor confers with Nell, Nina, and Rudy about which hospital to go to, how to get there, and what to expect upon arrival. He also warns us that traffic will be difficult, even more of an existential nightmare than usual. Today, he reminds us, it's the Holi festival, the Hindu holiday that celebrates spring. We are permitted to jump the line and rush through customs. The production crew stays behind to collect our luggage while we head to the hospital. We step outside the airport arrivals door in hopes of spotting our current driver. I am stopped in my tracks by my introduction to Delhi. Everyone is honking and screaming, the deafening buzz and chatter of what seems through the haze to be a million people. Unlike the clear Himalayan ether, the air is so thick with pollution that we choke on it. It feels as if we are actually breathing in solids, and our exhales are reduced to sputters. The lack of visibility is shocking. The driver holds a fox sign in the middle of traffic. We motion for him to stay there as we make our way to him. The car is splattered with pastel colors, and the driver is a human rainbow. This is what the doctor was referring to when he warned us that this is no ordinary day in Delhi, and we were already prepared to accept that there are no ordinary days in Delhi. On this, the second day of the festival, Rangali Holi, the custom is to grab fists of sticky, vividly colored pastel paint powder and throw it at the face, body, and clothing of any person within range. As we drive to the hospital, clouds of colored powder explode on the windshield. Blue for Krishna, the god of love, green for rebirth and new beginnings, red for marriage and fertility, and apparently for when the going gets fancy, yellow, the color of turmeric. It is a free-for-all. No one is spared. Every caste, gender, and age participates, often with paint loaded into squirt guns and water balloons. Everyone has a piece of the madness. The Delhi I see out my paint-splattered window is more than I can process, and in no way sufficient to create an understanding. En route to Bhutan last week, we didn't leave the airport on our layover in Delhi. In fact, we didn't leave the lounge. So this is my first experience in India. When I look at the roiling sea of humans, cows, and vehicles, I think back to Thimphu and the ornately costumed citizens waiting patiently for the man in the kiosk to wave them across the street. Clearly, we are in a different country. As intrigued as I am, the pain in my finger hasn't subsided. With the car windows tightly sealed to keep us from the chaos, we remain our original hues, but we are perspiring in 100-degree heat. Even with all that sweat, the ring still won't slide off. I wonder about the hospital, but I'm comforted by something my medical friend told me on the plane. You'll be in good hands. There are more doctors per capita in Delhi than in the United States. At last, we arrive at the hospital. While Nell pays the driver, I fumble in my pockets for a bottle of pills. This is the worst time for a shaky hand. Symptoms are starting to show, but I want to be steady for whatever awaits me inside. India Blue. The emergency intake and adjacent reception area is crowded, but considering the color wars raging outside the doors, it's more orderly than I expect. An intern leads me to a corridor outside of a presently occupied exam room. Just a few short steps away, a blue man is being treated for what appears to be trouble breathing. He isn't blue from what ails him, but from the paint splattered over his skin and clothing. The man's concerned family, all speaking to him at once, gather around him, striking figures in green, red, and yellow. What is it? Asthma, I wonder? Or a heart attack? Comparison and equivalency, who's got it worse? If it is asthma, that's probably an even trade for an amputated finger. Would my blue friend make that trade? Not if he knew the missing finger came with 20 years of progressive Parkinson's. From my side of the bargain, if it's a heart attack, no thanks. I think of the maxim, if we were all to put our worst problems inside of a circle and then be allowed to draw one out, we'd all take our own problem back. I hope he isn't having a heart attack, and I hope like hell I'm not about to get my finger chopped off. We enter the next available examining room with the same setup as any Western hospital. The doctor takes a preliminary look at my hand. It's not good. Things have clearly progressed to a tricky place. My finger is now so swollen and discolored that at first glance it's difficult to see the ring. It's almost wholly enveloped in engorged tissue. How do you cut it off without cutting off part of my finger? It just now hits me how much I love to play guitar. The doctor asks me a few basic questions about what happened. He quietly pronounces, "We must get that ring off or you will lose your finger." Yeah, I've heard that. Additional hospital staff members gradually appear. Each seems invested in coming up with a solution. It's becoming a hot topic in the ER, a conundrum that's gone viral throughout the hospital. What ensues amounts to a Keystone Cops carousel of various staff, from medical doctors to maintenance workers, each with a different method, some exotic, all ineffective. Hacksaws, wire cutters, tin snips, a disturbing mini guillotine-like device, petroleum jelly, ghee butter, and other lubricants are all employed, to no avail. I wish I had something to contribute, but I'm stumped. Well, not yet. An instrument of the file variety finally does the trick. A doctor enters holding a small coil of wire. Her proposal is to feed the wire between my finger and the ring, pull it through until the ends are equidistant, then grab each end and work it like dental floss. Whoa, I say, you're going to floss my finger off. She explains that the theory is to exert pressure upward and into the metal, until a small groove is established that will allow for a slightly larger and raspier wire to be applied. She goes to work, and ultimately enough room is created for a suitable cutting tool to finish the job. After all the aborted attempts to set me free, this works. Once the band is removed, there's an instant flush of relief. I'm assured there are no broken bones, only torn ligaments. The ring is a write-off, but I carefully collect the bits and pieces, put them in my pocket, and make plans to have it re-soldered in the not-too-distant future. After we thank everyone, the doctors ask me if I'll take photos with them. I'm happy to show off my elaborately bandaged left hand with its splinted digit. We step outside into the heat and glaring sun of the parking lot. For the second time, I download India. I'm glad we have a few days to spend in Delhi. Before the group breaks up, I have to ask the intern, "By the way, what happened to the blue guy?" He's confused. "Blue guy?" I say, "Yeah, came in about the same time as me, blue paint. I think he had asthma, maybe allergies." "Oh yes," he answers. "That man had a heart attack." "Is he okay?" He shakes his head. "He died." I think of his family washing off the paint. There will be rituals and constellations, much the same as at home. As different from home as India itself. No comparison. A week of Zen gone sideways. Chapter 5. Double Bogey. Why me? Why did this happen? I have a wife and children, a life that I love. So why was I afflicted with golf? To take up golf in my 40s was ambitious. To do so with Parkinson's disease was delusional. And yet that's what I did. What buoyed my spirits and stoked my enthusiasm originally was this simple concept. By my mid-40s, my physical decline, though not precipitous, was inarguable. I could still do some things well, but not as well as I once did. Golf became the exception. Every time I hit the links, I performed slightly better than I did the last time. Never mind that it could be graded in various degrees of lousy. The person most responsible for my entree into the golfing world was Ed Levy, a fellow Parkinson's patient and eminence grease on the Michael J. Fox Foundation board. In the early years of our organization, Ed and a few of his Wall Street friends proposed an annual golf tournament to complement the variety of ways we raise funds for research. I was dubious. Wasn't much of a golf fan. Didn't play the game. I always figured there's plenty of time for golf when I'm dead. "Do we really want to do golf events?" I asked. The answer was yes. The outing was a huge success. I couldn't attend that first year, but as the second year approached, Ed asked me if I'd caddy for him. He was older than me and further along in the progression of his disease. I was much more able-bodied than I am now, so I agreed to do it with a caveat. Instead of lugging Ed's clubs around, I threw them in the back of a cart and volunteered to drive. I had a blast, and the next year I decided to play. Ed was the first of many golf mentors, a disparate band of duffers who have dragged me under the green glare of courses all around the world, from the municipal to the magnificent. There's my neighbor Teddy, who lives 5 houses down from me on Long Island, and other seasoned players like George Stephanopoulos, Harlan Coben, Jimmy Fallon, and Bill Murray. They aren't like dads who you don't want to disappoint, but like favorite uncles, the kind who let stuff slide, who sneak you a beer when you're 17. The uncles look past my difficulties in playing golf with Parkinson's and embrace the truth that golf is hell for everyone. We all feel the burn. The joy is not in overcoming or defeating it, instead it's in surviving it and settling bets at the 19th hole. Like every gladiator out there on the killing fields, the uncles really only give a shit about their game, not yours or mine. Just keep it moving and everything's copacetic. Better players don't mind lousy, but they can't abide slow. They're obsessed with completing a round under the time allotted by the course starter. In my case, when the unks are putting, I'm still in the fairway bunker 4 or 5 shots off the green. I just pick up my ball, put it in my pocket, and then make my way to the next tee. I'm not keeping score anyway. The uncles approve. From the start, anyone paying attention could see that I had no affinity for the game. After our first round of 9 holes together, my good friend Cam Neely, a founding member of the Golf Uncles and an NHL Hall of Famer, hockey players are famous for being prodigious golfers, summed up my game thusly. "Your problem, Mike," he paused, "is loft." "How can I have a problem with loft?" I asked. "I can barely get the ball off the ground." "No," he said, "L-O-F-T, lack of fucking talent." When you're as preternaturally bad as I am, friends, strangers, and concerned groundkeepers are quick to offer annoyingly helpful suggestions. My all-time favorite, "be still over the ball." Be still over the ball. I like to be still over my soup. Arnold Palmer once wrote, yes, it's that bad, I'm actually reading about golf. "Think of your feet and head as 3 apexes of an immovable triangle." Thanks, Arnie. I'll be sure to pack a protractor and a slide rule in my bag, along with my bug spray and nose zinc. And thanks also for the refreshing beverage. T-box trigonometry aside, Arnie was probably the ultimate golf uncle for a lot of neophytes. Less approachable, Tiger Woods is not known for sharing his golf wisdom, but he does always promise that on Sunday at the Masters he will bring his A game. I could only threaten to bring a game. Tracy was both amused and bemused by all of this. While delighted that I had a new pastime, one that gave me so much pleasure and got me out of the house and moving my body, she would have a particular reaction when I would talk about the cheerful bonhomie of my golf uncles and how they welcomed me into their fold. "Mike, listen, they're crack dealers. Only the crack is golf. They got you hooked and reeled you in. I'm happy that you love playing, honey, and I'm happy you made so many friends, but I'm just saying, crack." Breakfast ball. It's just after sunrise. My friend Teddy from down the block is coming to pick me up in his noisy 1970 Buick Skylark. Where are my silly half socks? Where are my good shorts? Not the ones from 3 summers ago that are too small now. I'm on tiptoes in the semi-darkness, trying not to wake Tracy. My wife deserves a peaceful Sunday morning sleep-in, so I try to get my stuff ready the night before. But I always forget something. If I'm making too much noise, it's because there's a fire in my belly. I'm going golfing. I check the list. Pills, sunscreen, sunglasses, extra tees, shirt, shorts, belt, shoes, and a pair of ankle-cut sport socks. When I sit down to put these on my feet, I notice with chagrin that Nike has decided to label the socks left and right. The problem is, I'm holding 2 lefts. I am perturbed. This feels like a jinx. 2 left socks. What, do I have 2 left feet? I hear the voice of my dad. "Then there must be a pair of rights somewhere in your sock drawer, son." Switching them out means re-entering the bedroom and definitely waking Tracy this time. Just because I'm up at 6:15 doesn't mean she has to be. Or so she said. "To hell with it. I'll go with the 2 left socks. I'm not happy about it, but there it is. Our tea time is 7:30. Soon I'm sitting on my porch with my clubs waiting for Teddy to roll up in his convertible. He does, and a half an hour later we're on the first tee with the other two in our foursome. It's my favorite time of the day. The dew still beads the grass, and the songbirds are in full throat. I pull my lucky driver out of the bag and lead us off. This is the last time I'll go first all day. It's called the honor system. The winner of the previous hole has the honor of teeing off at the next. I'm never that guy. My pills haven't quite kicked in yet, so it takes 15 attempts to place and balance my ball on the tee. The boys are used to this. I don't ask for their help, and none is offered. I set the ball up. It wobbles and rolls off. I repeat the same result over and over. I make a joke about occupational therapy. By the time I finally secure the ball in place, I indulge in a silent affirmation. This is your moment. You know what to do. I run through my list of swing thoughts. Keep your feet planted on the ground. Left toe pointed slightly forward. Soften your knees. Find your center of gravity. Chin up. Pause at the top of the backswing. Keep your eyes down on the follow-through. Two left socks. Holy shit! The ball slices right into the parking lot. Four! Thankfully, I hear no screaming or breaking glass, although I find out later that I almost nailed Dr. Phillips, a big muckety-muck at the club, whom I had only recently convinced to accept me for membership. I reach into my pocket to pull out a breakfast ball, the do-over mulligan traditional for first-hole misfires. This time, I purge socks from my mind. I forget about my swing. I just think about the moment the club strikes the ball, like a hockey stick and puck. It's all about contact. Don't overthink. I reach back, pause in my backswing, and deliver the club head with sufficient force to send the ball soaring 180 yards, straight down the fairway, a mere pitching wedge away from the green. I turn to my friends. I know, any asshole can hit the second shot. Every time I play can either be the best round or the worst. Today it's been both. The clock at the 18th hole tells us we're 10 minutes ahead of schedule. Everyone is satisfied and can hold their heads up in the clubhouse. But not me. I'm thinking, well, that's it. My last round of golf. Why am I wasting everyone's time? But there was that breakfast ball. That one that set me up for a possible birdie. I went on to four putt. Still, one to grow on. Golf celebrates your vulnerabilities and shames you for having the temerity to even pick up a club. Yet should I get a phone call, text, or email that three buddies are looking for a fourth, I'll drop everything. One well-played hole in a round of 18, if successfully negotiated for birdie, par, or even an honest bogey, can lure me back for another round of abuse. All memory of 17 disastrous holes magically erased. Mark Twain famously described the game of golf as a good walk spoiled. For me, it's more of a good shuffle, tumble, lurch. With balance issues, I'm prone to falls, one of the few people who can injure himself while putting. Golf summons up the same resolve that I rely upon in managing my Parkinson's. I could easily create a Venn diagram exploring the nexus between golf and life with PD. They overlap in hubris and humility, delusion and desire, futility and resilience. I just deal with whatever presents itself. Sometimes I end up in the bunker, in the deep rough, or in the water. Carry on. If you're going to do something, just do it. Don't use too much club. A commonly asked question on the links is, what's your handicap? My answer? Isn't it obvious? The sport and disability have met and intermingled in my experience as a golfer patient and an impatient golfer. Who knew that Ed Levy's invitation to caddy would introduce me to the unexpected joy of the world's most frustrating sport? I'm grateful, I think. A decade later, PD will force Ed to hang up his clubs. Through the years that I continue playing, the game becomes an escape, a relief, a release from the preoccupation with my health situation. When you're golfing, all you can think about is golf. Not long after Ed's retirement from the game, my own health will relegate my clubs to storage, for a while or perhaps forever. In a way, Parkinson's pitted itself against golf. For a time there, golf was winning. My game was getting better at a faster pace than my Parkinson's was getting worse. Not exactly advanced analytics, but eventually the data will turn against me. Chapter 6. Locomotion. I used to defy gravity on a daily basis, and I could run like a quarter horse. Now I'm 58 years old and I perambulate like I'm 90. No, wait, I know a couple of 90-year-olds who jog, for Christ's sake. They leave me standing in the dust while their jet stream tips me over. An old guy with a cane hustle passed my office the other day. Admiring the rhythm of his stick work, my only thought was, look at that son of a bitch go. That's what I aspire to now. I want to move like that guy. But really, I want to move like I did as a kid. Slippery quick. In 1971, when I was 10, my dad retired from the Canadian Armed Forces. We left Ontario, his last posting, to return to British Columbia, where my family had roots. We moved from army housing into an apartment complex, across the street from a strip mall and a liquor store. Within weeks, I had explored every back alley, side street, and shortcut in and around the neighborhood. Having memorized the route from our complex to the apartment where my aunt and uncle lived, 5 miles away, I thought nothing of making the trek by myself, unannounced and unaccompanied. Once I arrived, I would enjoy a cold glass of tap water while Aunt Marilyn called my mom to report my location. Back then, I'd just start walking. Walk to school, walk through the woods, walk to the movies. I rode my bike, too, and I could skate. A typical Canadian kid, I played hockey from the age of 6. I was built for speed, low to the ground, spontaneous and impulsive, nimble with panther reflexes. In hockey, or in sports in general, they describe someone with quick legs as having great wheels. The legendary Montreal Canadian Guy Lafleur had wheels. I had wheels. Lafleur also had hands, that is, he had the facility to stick handle, to move the puck on the blade of the stick in strange and magical ways that allowed him to become a proficient scorer. I didn't have hands, nor did I have what coaches call hockey sense, in that I couldn't see the game in a visionary way. Unlike Wayne Gretzky, who could deliver a puck not to where his teammate was, but to where they were going to be. I didn't have much of a shot either, but man, could I fly. I patrolled the ice with such speed, agility, and flair that you could easily be fooled into thinking I was actually doing something. I loved the movement, being a blur. A perpetual motion machine, I was constantly running, jumping, hurdling, sprinting, skipping a rope in the boxing gym, scrambling over rocks at the shoreline, casting and reeling, pitching and hitting, skiing and body surfing, climbing up the brick wall to the roof of the liquor store to retrieve an errant street hockey ball, sneaking my arm over a date's shoulder at the movies. George Bernard Shaw said that youth is wasted on the young, but it wasn't wasted on me. I just didn't know that I'd go straight from young to old. Moving pieces. From childhood into adulthood, I continued to exploit my physicality, not only for fun, but for profit. Over the course of my career, I've executed pratfall, shoulder rolls, and fake fights, occasionally landing a wayward punch and taking one in return. I've leapt off buildings, flown on wires, and skateboarded through studio backlots. I've been choreographed by Broadway director Herb Ross, who turned a stroll through an office building in The Secret of My Success into a scene out of a Harold Lloyd movie. Herb challenged me to navigate a maze of file cabinets with extended drawers, shuttering elevator doors, the mops and buckets of maintenance workers, and other workplace hazards. All of this, regrettably, to the tune of Walking on Sunshine. As a director, Brian De Palma could not be more different from Herb Ross. But Brian created his own form of choreography. He's famous for his extended Steadicam shots, minutes-long, continuous takes. For example, the camera might follow an actor along a hallway, down a staircase, out the door, to the street, and into a moving bus, all in one shot. I did one of these De Palma specials in Thailand while filming Casualties of War. It was, in its own way, some of the most physically demanding work I've ever done, and it involved nothing more arduous than walking. My character, a raw recruit, engages in nervous chatter with a fellow soldier, an existential conversation about how easy it is to get your ass killed in Vietnam. We do this as we trudge along a rutted dirt road, all hell breaking loose in the background. A village burns steadily, the flames fed by occasional explosions. Helicopters zip in and out, landing and taking off. Army personnel pass through the frame, firing weapons and hauling dead and wounded onto the choppers. All the while, pages and pages of dialogue have to be delivered with exquisite precision. Amid the manufactured bedlam, a too quick footstep or a misspoken line means an entire scene is blown, and 10 minutes of footage is lost. And that would be on you. Back to one. With all the horrific sounds, the gunshots, the bombs, the close whir of helicopters, the most terrifying one was Brian yelling, "Cut!" before the scene was meant to end. Back on safer ground, as Alex Keaton, I learned how to maneuver through a scene and around a set in the moment. I would fly through doors and slide across countertops with my hands in my pockets, somehow willing myself to float from camera mark to camera mark. I'd glide and spin on a rolling office chair across the proscenium of the kitchen set. It was basically all a dance, although I'm no dancer. One of the early scenes in the pilot episode of Spin City takes place in a small Manhattan apartment bedroom. My character, Deputy Mayor Mike Flaherty, and his girlfriend, Ashley, a political reporter, are in a back-and-forth dialogue about moving in together permanently. A few double entendres, a few sexy eye flutters, and the scene turns romantic. For what Mike has in mind next, he needs to get from one side of the room over the bed to the other and have his sweatpants off by the time he lands. I proposed to the director, Tommy Shalhoub, a legendary TV director with one of the best monikers in show business, that I do this by flipping over the bed with Ashley lying in it and removing my sweatpants in midair. "Okay," he said, "I'll buy it, but how the hell do you know you can do that?" "I don't, but I think I can. Let me try." "Do I get a vote?" Carla Gugino, who played Ashley, spoke up. "Just don't land on me." And don't break your neck, Tommy said. I'd have to fill out a lot of forms. Somehow, I managed to execute the maneuver flawlessly, to the delight and relief of everyone involved. It was a flying start to our pilot episode. PD Paradox. To me, movement always represented freedom. It was a couple of years into my Parkinson's diagnosis that I recognized movement disorder as an accepted handle for my affliction. I'm sure I'd been using materials I'd read or mentioned by doctors I'd consulted, but in time, the full meaning of those words sank in. Mine is not a mental disorder nor an emotional one, although these issues can develop. It is neurological and manifests in a corruption of movement. Some people will focus on the slight palsy, the trembling of fingers and limbs. That's certainly part of it. But, at least in my experience, these symptoms have become more manageable over time. Much more difficult to acknowledge and accept is the diminishment of movement. Absent a chemical intervention, Parkinson's will render me frozen, immobile, stone-faced, and mute, entirely at the mercy of my environment. For someone for whom motion equals emotion, vibrancy, and relevance, it's a lesson in humility. On the upside, I found that I can play mind games with myself. I employ a strategy I've used throughout my life. If I don't know I can do something physically, I just pretend that I can. Fake it till I make it. 8 times out of 10, it works. The remaining 20%? Stitches, broken bones, humiliation. The impatient patient. Someone who helps me demark the lines and boundaries I face in life is Dr. Susan Bressman. She's my neuro and movement disorder specialist. Also a brilliant researcher, an internationally recognized expert in Parkinson's disease, and a valued advisor to her foundation. We're lucky to have her on our team, and I'm grateful for her personal attention. She's always thorough in my one-hour checkups, during which she assesses my present disposition and rate of progression, audits my reported reactions to medications, and monitors my cognitive skills and mental acuity. It can be exhausting. Sometimes I'm on during the examinations, and sometimes I'm off, all of which is duly observed and noted. I wish everyone could have the careful consideration of their illness, as I do with Sue. As I leave her office after each appointment, I know she's standing in the hallway behind me, assessing the quality of my stride. When I think about walking, a word that now comes to my mind is deliberate. I have to plan every step I take. No extraneous side trips or wasted efforts. I have to think about the way I sit in a chair. Am I settled in the right way? I do an inventory of where my limbs are. All of this calculation and deliberation is rigorous work. Physical tasks are made more difficult by the need to break them down into all of their components. Required mental work is harder than the physical effort. I need to think about every step, which demands intense focus. I have to show up, although it would be so easy not to. Some days I'm done with it all. I don't want to count my steps. I don't want to acknowledge what's worse today or what will probably get worse down the road. It's exhausting to parse out what is Parkinson's and what's attributable to other factors. Some things I can't do because I'm 58. Is that old age? It was when I was 21, which feels like 5 minutes ago. Down in the corner. Unlike when I was 21 and living in a roach-infested studio apartment in L.A., I now reside in a pre-war building on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. Efforts have been made to modernize the property, or at least acquire modern accessories. For example, an abandoned, oversized basement laundry room, replete with vestigial washers and dryers from the 1950s, has been cleaned out, renovated, and is now a residence gym. This is where I receive physical therapy. My PT, Ryan Orser, while physically imposing, is wholly personable, funny, and engaging. An accomplished lacrosse player and a big fan of his hometown Buffalo Bills, he brings an athlete's perspective to his work. He knows his stuff. The name of every bone, muscle, ligament, and tendon, how they all work together, or don't. I asked Ryan how he would describe the work he does with Parkinson's patients. I mean, it's not purely physical therapy, right? There's something else going on, I say. He cracks an impish grin, if the word impish can be applied to someone that huge. It's like physical therapy. If the therapist had a mother who was a psychologist, a father who was an ergonomist, a brother who was a dancer, and a mind that is perpetually 15. Works for me. My office is around the corner from our apartment. So to get from my office to the home gym, I have to go outside, hang a right, go about 30 feet, take another right for 40 feet, and enter the lobby doors under the canopy. This used to be a piece of real estate I could cover without a second's thought. Nothing more than a short commute, or the last steps of the trip home from the coffee shop on Madison Avenue, or the bookshop in the corner. It's now the Bermuda Triangle, or more accurately, the Devil's Right Angle. That's where Ryan comes in. Before each workout, he meets me at the office and we discuss what we're going to do that day, therapy-wise. First priority, laying out a strategy for negotiating the 350 steps of my exterior office door into my apartment building and down the stairs to the gym, factoring in variables like the weather, my current on-off status, and the time of day. Sounds simple, and some days it is. But on other days, like today, it's a perilous odyssey, worthy of Ulysses. Just stepping out the door is tricky. To make an immediate right necessitates a quick glance to the left to check for incoming pedestrian traffic. The first step is crucial. I want to make sure it's not complicated by passers-by. There's no such thing in my world as a quick glance anymore. It requires that my whole body, including my feet, shifts. Seeing that all is clear, I turn right, into the wind. Our particular corner, whether it's airflow vectors or just the shape of our building juxtaposed against the building across the street, confronted by the stone walls of Central Park, conspires to create the most blustery city corner this side of Chicago. Gusts of up to 50 miles per hour have literally knocked me down in recent winters. Even without the blowback, it's freezing today in New York. Sidewalks are slick and icy, and frost heaves have warped the pavement, creating dangerous lips and ledges. The corner always seems to be jammed up with life forms, whether a pet owner dragging his cardigan-sweatered French bulldog out for a pee, or on nicer days, a young teacher shepherding 12 tethered preschoolers. The second right turn can be a deal-breaker. I've fallen here many times, leaving a patina of knee skin on the concrete. Having found my way around it, I'm now faced with an even more precipitous downhill jaunt into the lobby. The pace is quicker today, so my stride is shorter. The frost has done its damage here too, so there are countless toe catchers waiting to drop me if I shuffle. My reflex is to close down my hips in hope that it will control my pace. The actual result is the limiting of my options. Another risk is that I'll run into a gaggle of my neighbors waiting for taxis or unloading groceries from their cars, or at least supervising doormen as they schlep the bags inside. The temptation is to stop and say hi, be friendly. Wrong. Do not stop. Do not make eye contact. Do not engage. It's clear you're struggling. You've got a cane, for Christ's sake. They'll understand. I step up in and away and take the left this time to the service stairway that leads down to the basement. The running of that gauntlet, believe it or not, is followed by an hour of physical therapy. Brain sweat. Core work crunches, sit-ups, bicycle kicks, the dreaded ab chair. We always start off with the fun stuff. Okay, walk over here. Hips forward, shoulders back. Don't drag that left foot, Ryan commands. While I'm concentrating on lifting my left foot, I hyperextend my right knee. Damn. It's okay, we're going to work on that later, Ryan says. A willing student, I work my ass off, but I get a little cranky and whiny as I'm put through my paces. Ryan flops a rubber mat down on the faux pine floor and says, toe touches. Right knee up, left leg down, touch your right foot with your left hand, then switch. Give me 20 of those. It takes me a second to picture the movement, even though I've done this 100 times before. But I want to be sure, because I know what's coming next. I do one, I do two, I do three, and here it comes. Ryan says, who is the 16th president of the United States? I grunt, reaching out to grab my left toe. Lincoln? I don't know. I'm Canadian. Correct. What is 3 times 3 minus 7 plus 2? He's jumping all over my brain in areas where I store information. I hesitate and grab my left toe twice. Zero, I grunt. Not a zilch. While all this is going on, he's laying out a course of pylons 2 paces apart. They zigzag the length of the gym floor. I stand in front of the first one, get my balance, take a big step, and slalom my way through the course. I have to go slowly and carefully. On my second step, he starts in again. Name the planets in order from the sun. I get the Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars intro out of the way, but what's next, Jupiter or Saturn? Jupiter, I take a guess. Right, Ryan says, don't hyperextend, loosen that knee up, strike your heel, slow your pace, concentrate. I can't concentrate, I complain. You're sabotaging me. Then I blurt out, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. I turn, my left foot dragging into a pylon, knocking it over and nearly bringing myself down with it. And sometimes Pluto. Ryan laughs and says, I bet you're thinking, you asked me to do all these goddamn things. I can't even stand in front of a toilet and pee straight. At least I still stand, I answer. After another 45 minutes of working out, treadmill, rowing machine, and a selection of stretching exercises approved by Torquemada, today's session is done. We collect our things, put on coats and hats, and prepare to retrace the series of rights and lefts, mostly lefts this time, back to the office. Even exiting through the gym's door is an opportunity to reinforce my therapy. These kinds of transitions cause my brain to hiccup. Passing through doorways poses a challenge, depending on what I'm stepping out of and into. I do a quick reset, then proceed on steady legs. We have to take the staircase to the lobby instead of waiting for the service elevator. It may seem counterintuitive, but stairs are easier for me to negotiate than flat surfaces. My problem is not strength, it's coordination. Stair treads are plain in their visual language. They prescribe the height to which I have to raise my foot, as well as how far forward and how flat my footfall should be. The handrail doesn't hurt either. Ryan keeps talking. Do you remember how you were sitting when I first met you? I don't know, on my ass? Yeah, but you also had your leg on the ottoman. The other leg was on the ground, pushed into the corner of the couch. You had one outstretched arm here and another arm here. Just to balance, you had to touch all of these points of contact.
Like Ralph Macchio doing the crane in Karate Kid?
Ryan nods. You were like that because you wanted to pay attention to our conversation. The rest of us don't have to worry about what our bodies are doing when we talk to people, but you really need to focus. Movement can be intensely distracting. We reach the heavy brass and glass lobby door. He holds it open and I pass through without hesitation. Okay, Ryan says from behind me. Let's take this next part slowly. Stop, set your feet, think about where you're going. Short uphill to the corner, turn, pause again, count your steps. The bright sun bounces off the concrete. The afternoon traffic tumbles downtown and the sidewalks are lightly populated. I nod, take a medium yoga breath, and I'm on my way. 1, 2, 3. Ryan is counting aloud beside me, out of my line of sight. 6, 7. Suddenly, I get distracted. Does that lady have a dog in her handbag? My left leg hyperextends and I start to pitch toward the building's sidewalk garden. In a second, Ryan's arm shoots out to grab and steady me. He catches me into the armpit, pulls me upright again. Giving me a grim smile, he nudges me forward. 8, 9, 10, counts a little louder. What Ryan's doing is simple. He's trying to teach my mind to perform one exercise while my body performs another. I need to create new pathways in my brain, new ways of compartmentalizing actions and words. Basically, what he's teaching me is not only how to walk and talk at the same time, but how to safely think about other things while still being aware of the kinetics involved in moving from place to place. I find myself reciting tongue twisters, fuzzy wuzzy wuzzy and fuzzy wuzzy, when I do push-ups and bicycle crunches in my office. If she sells seashells, then I'm buying, because this stuff is working. I may one day master multitasking, but I prefer Ryan go easy on the math. Chapter 7. Unsafe at any speed. I love my mother too much to give her a hug. I've traveled the width of the country and across an international border to surprise Mom. It's Canadian Thanksgiving, and more importantly, her 90th birthday. Unleashing an emotional surprise on a 90-year-old is a dodgy proposition at best. But I pulled this kind of unannounced pop-up with her before. 10 years ago, my brother Steve and I delivered room service to her hotel suite in Belfast, Northern Ireland, where she was touring with my sisters Jackie and Kelly. The day they left on their trip, Steve and I were talking on the phone, and one of us came up with the outlandish idea to fly to Belfast the following day and surprise them. It was so last minute and tightly scheduled, the only flights we could get required Steve to fly from Vancouver to JFK and then immediately transfer by car to Newark, New Jersey for our overseas flight. There's no easy way to get from airport to airport without taking a diagonal trip across Manhattan. I picked up Steve via car service and soon we were trapped in Metro New York traffic, crawling through the Lincoln Tunnel and then onto the terminal in Newark with only a few minutes to spare. An off-duty airport cop volunteered to expedite us through security and blaze the shortest trail to the gate. Luggage in tow. He put his foot in the cabin door as the flight attendant was closing it and tossed the two of us onto the plane. We made it to Belfast just in time for breakfast. There was a higher purpose to our madness. We had always wanted to take a trip abroad as a family, but my father was no longer with us, and our older sister Karen had passed away a couple of years earlier. My two surviving sisters, Kelly and Jackie, had organized this pilgrimage with Mom to her ancestral homeland in Northern Ireland. Steve and I saw this as an opportunity to affirm family ties. We wanted in on Phyllis Piper Fox's return to a home she'd never been to before. Mom's reaction upon realizing that the gents bearing her room service tray were her two sons was a mixture of shock and delight. Now, 10 years later, my big brother and I hatch another plan. Steve and his family live only a few miles from Mom, and he often drops by to do handiwork and chores around her high-rise condo. He tells her that he'll be over the next morning and he'll call from the lobby so she can buzz him up. When she opens the door, surprise, it won't be Steve, it'll be me. This works to perfection, except Mom doesn't answer the door. My sister Kelly does. It's probably better this way. We avoid the shock of a nose-to-nose reveal, which might give my mother a heart attack. Kelly steps back. Mom, rising from the sofa in the living room, sees me and brings her hands to her face. She lets out a sort of a squeak. Hey, Mom, hope you weren't expecting room service. In the excitement of the reunion, I fear stumbling, careening, and slamming into my 90-year-old mother, taking us both out. 8 to 10 steps from the threshold to the door to the sofa, I agonize over each footfall. Wherever I land, I need to be stable before I go in for a hug. Careful not to lean too far forward, which would push her back, but instead manage to receive her in a way that allows room for me to adjust. For Christ's sake, just don't knock her down. At the very least, I could re-break her hip. After a long and slightly trembling hug, I step back, as if to take her in, but mostly just to keep her safe by keeping my distance. She looks fit and happy. Me, I'm just happy.
Over 30 years of Parkinson's, I progressed into something dangerous. I've been weaponized. Most recently, my mobility and balance issues have definitely worsened. I struggle with consistency, establishing and maintaining a steady rhythm in my gait, thus the careful attention paid to the quick trip from the door to my mother. Paradoxically, standing for any length of time is also a wobbly proposition. And it's not just Mom who I endanger, merely by the slightest intrusion into her personal space. My mother-in-law Corky, who is a contemporary of my mom, is also at risk for me and needs a careful approach. In fact, New Yorkers, tourists, and random citizens just busying their way down Madison Avenue, blithely tapping on their cell phones, have no idea that a tornado of terror is limping in their direction. I have to be vigilant, careful not just for myself, but for anyone who is unfortunate enough to be in my unpredictable path. Sometimes I view the world as a pinball game, and I am a steel ball fired from the spring plunger, trying desperately not to light up any buttons on the way to the flipper doors. Weirdly, I have dreams about this dearth of kinetic self-control. One goes like this. I am rounding the street corner on the way to my apartment building, holding a vial of Parkinson's meds. I stumble and slam into a mailbox, whereupon the capsules spill out onto the sidewalk. I stoop to collect the pharmaceuticals, then look up to see a dog walker with a teeming pack of Upper East Side hounds moving in to gobble up the drugs. God knows what kind of damage this would do to a canine's insides. Although, given the neighborhood, the dogs are probably on some kind of antidepressant already. I wake up with Gus licking my face. The uncertainty principle. The German theoretical physicist Werner Heisenberg established a number of laws and principles that, along with the work of a coterie of other geniuses, led to the creation of quantum mechanics. Heisenberg's work earned him the 1932 Nobel Prize in Physics. The theory that bears his name is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which states that the more precisely the position of a particle is determined, the less precisely its momentum can be known, and vice versa. Heisenberg describes exactly the conundrum that we Parkinsonians face in dealing with gait. I cannot determine my position and velocity at the same time. It's an unsolvable problem. People caution me to slow down as I shuffle steps, stumble forward, but they don't realize that it's an impossible request. I simply can't feel how fast I'm going. Moreover, my brain won't let my body stop until it finds a safe position, and it can't find a safe position while I'm still moving. This relates directly to Heisenberg's principle. Joseph Heller would also lay claim to it as a classic catch-22. It's a dilemma from which there is no escape because of mutually conflicting conditions. Here's how I visualize it. If my body was sectioned into tenths horizontally, each tenth would be traveling at its own speed. And not in any sequence, it makes sense. I'm never still long enough to gauge my body's position as a whole. Adding to the chaos, the quickening of pace and simultaneous shortening of stride, cardinal features of advanced Parkinson's, sabotage my journey. My pace quickens beyond the brain neuron's capacity to fire, and I can suddenly lose my balance. 9 times out of 10, I manage to panic dance all my horizontal sections in the hopes that they'll all fall into line and recover equilibrium before I steamroll somebody. And people think Parkinson's disease is all about tremor. I thought that once too. Surprise, again. I savored the time in Canada with my mother and my family, especially when there's a reason to celebrate. The day after I arrive, Steve, Jackie, Kelly, and I take Mom to lunch at a local pizza place in Burnaby, the suburb of Vancouver where I grew up. It's a family favorite. We've been going there since we were kids. It's been spruced up since then with leather banquettes instead of picnic tables, but the pizza still tastes like sixth grade. We order a few pies and some soft drinks, and then the fun starts. Mom's cell phone rings. Hello, she answers. Hey, Nana. I just wanted to wish you a happy birthday. Mom points to her phone and tells us, it's Sam calling from Los Angeles. She goes back to her grandson.
Oh, thank you, sweetie. I bet you know about my surprise. Your dad's here. Do you want to talk to him? No, just have him call me. Actually, never mind. He can't call me. I have his phone. With that, Sam walks around the corner to our table. We all look to Mom. Again, the hands to the face and the tiny squeak. Again, thank God, no myocardial infarction. Sam hands me back my cell phone, sits down next to my mother, and wraps her in a hug. Nothing dangerous about it. A safe, stable, normal hug. After lunch, my 90-year-old mother drives us to a bowling alley. We bowl 2 games and Mom kicks our asses. Yes, my mother still bowls, and she still drives. Every few years, I buy her a Volkswagen Passat, but she operates safely without incident. I turned in my car keys almost a decade ago. In my 20s, I owned 5 kinds of sports cars, and a few variations on the Range Rover. I could match light a cigarette going 80 miles an hour in my Ferrari, with the top down. With marriage and babies came 4-door sedans and child car seats, no more sports cars. And then on my 35th birthday, Tracy led me outside of our apartment building on Central Park West, where I found my gift curbside, a red 1967 Mustang convertible with vintage plates that declared it as a registered antique. It was 6 years younger than me. I zipped around in that car for years, until my early 50s, when I found that my right foot was consistently and rhythmically pumping the throttle. The car would accelerate, decelerate, lurching down the road as I struggled to control it. That'll take the sexy out of a red convertible. Another safety issue, my increasing uneasiness about the proximity of other cars on the roadway, a PD-related spatial perception deficit. I also developed a tendency to steer in whatever direction I was looking. All of this convinced me that, despite the fact that I still had a valid driver's license, I was unsafe at any speed. My mother, on the other hand, manages just fine. Being born during the Depression and coming of age during World War II made Mom tough, determined, and indefatigable. When my daughter Esme celebrated her bat mitzvah, my mother insisted on flying to New York while still recovering from a broken hip. Despite her doctor's firm remonstration, she wasn't going to miss the celebration. That's my mom. She loves life and her passions belie her age. Mom helps me not to think of age as a metric. Who's to say what constitutes the span of a life? When you're 100 and you pass away, no one says what happened. Your demise is considered overdue. You were living on bonus time anyway. But there are people like my mother and my mother-in-law who are exceptions to this trope. Mom and Corky remain vital and active. They're not going anywhere soon. Energetic and engaged in their 90s, they are still the architects of their own lives. In my 50s, I'm envious. Chapter 8, Exile on Payne Street. New Year's Eve, 2017. Turks and Caicos, British Overseas Territory. Keith Richards, drink in hand, a massive skull ring tapping the crystal of his cocktail glass, lights a fresh cigarette off the cherry of his last.
Folksy!
His voice is a warm cackle.
Happy New Year.
Same to you, Keith. In actual fact, I feel anything but happy at the moment. While my family is vacationing at a celebrity-dense resort in Turks and Caicos during Christmas week, I am ailing from a pinched sciatic nerve, exacerbated by a recent fall in the hallway of my New York office. It is so painful, I can't even walk on the powdery sand without enduring, with each tentative step, a dragon pissing fire down the back of my leg. For the rest of the week, the closest I get to the ocean is the dune bar, and I don't drink. I sit like a mope, gazing beachward, sucking on a virgin pina colada, the irony not lost, and in spite of my abstemiousness, I still have a fair chance of sliding up my bar stool. In that bar I now wait, with Keith Richards, swashbuckling pirate king, immortal rock god, and rolling freaking stone, for the New Year's Eve fireworks. I'm not worthy. The crowd picks up the countdown. At 1, there's a sizzling whoosh and a loud riot of light in the night sky. Keith tilts his head up, his lined and weathered visage captured in a flash portrait, lit by a burst of white phosphorus. Oh, God. Keith Richards looks better than I feel. Vacations, particularly family vacations, by definition, remove us from the regular patterns and rhythms of our lives. We're vacating the everyday. We seek enjoyment and relaxation. Ours has always been a family on the move, and we've always loved traveling together. Now, with the kids being older, 2 out of college, 1 soon to graduate, 1 still in high school, it's more important than ever for us to spend downtime with each other and to catch up on how wings are unfolding outside of the nest. We travel for a number of special occasions and milestone celebrations, often in the company of other families and friends. Here in the Turks and Caicos, we are with good friends and neighbors, the Shankers, and their 2 sons and their daughter, Allie, who is so close to our girls that we call her the third twin.
We also engage in adventure